Hi neighbor, can we talk? May we survive together? That is a call under which this year's focal gathered in Billings, Montana, a month ago, November 3rd through 6th. Community survival and the role of the church in this age of economic concentration was what we 100 or so participants considered together. This year's focal was also attended by a group called Rural Chaplains Association, and that doubled the attendance. After we'd been welcomed, we were introduced to one of the initiators of focal, Dean Freudenberger, who told about focal's history and reminded us of the church's prophetic role. And in my words, focal was started to spend some time looking at agriculture and its role in society and agriculture's, or what farming was doing to the land. And then spent quite a bit of time on looking at other ways, or drawing out other ways that may already exist and bring them to the awareness of the farming community so that the rural community wouldn't be locked into certain patterns of unhealthy patterns of lifestyles. We were made aware of global concentration of the food systems by Karen Lehman of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, by a county agent from Montana, from Stillwater County, Chuck Egan, and by the chair of the Department for Rural Sociology at the University of Missouri, Bill Heffernan. To me, when I hear the term globalization, and in association with the food industry, it seems to refer to transnational companies that, as a part of their business, keep buying more companies here and abroad. The world's 25 largest tobacco and food companies, of those companies, 14 are US-based. Now, whether this concentration hurts commerce and the rural lifestyle as a whole is something that's very disputed. And the issue has been studied. The folks at Focal didn't think much of the study. They thought it was very tainted. They thought that the land grant colleges, who were the ones who conducted the studies, had been under a lot of pressure to come out with a viewpoint that would not come down on the food industry. According to Forbes, the top companies' median return on their equity is 18.7%. There's only one other industry that does better than that, and that's the pharmaceutical industry. Most of that capital is used for expansion by buying up smaller companies here and abroad. Sometimes they sell companies too, and we were given an example of that. A poultry plant in Canada was sold to a farmer-based co-op. Later, and then the co-op moved their processing plant to Mexico. No, sorry, the company moved their processing plant to Mexico. Then in Mexico, a journalist made some remark to the company about their move out of the Canadian market. And the company's reply was, "We never moved out of the Canadian market. We just moved the processing plant out." Now, what that would mean for the farmer-based co-op that bought their facility in Canada, that you can only guess. Because with a profit margin like these companies have, they are able to drive anybody out of business because they and lower the price in the region and keep it down without hurting themselves for a long, long time. We saw a very interesting chart that Bill Heffernan had. It was Cargill controlled companies all over the world. And they are in very many nations. Mostly they're in the United States and Canada. And some of the developing nations, they even have companies, maybe only one. And then to that presentation, he added, you will notice that Denmark is not on this list, and that is no accident. The same is the case for Norway and Sweden. I never got around to asking him, you know, why that was, but to me, it had to do with the way that the Danish farmers organized themselves 100 years ago. It's almost all cooperative when they sell the produce. Rural America's colony or community was presented us by his wife, Judy Heffernan. I at first couldn't understand that. How could rural America be a colony? But if you try to define what a colony is, it makes more sense. Colonies are areas where just enough capital is invested so that you can draw out the resources and capital that are there. And some of rural America finds itself in that mode. When the people who have the capital don't live where the capital operates, the money disappears out of the community fast. It doesn't change hands very often, and it's out. And we were given an example in the extreme. Walmart, when they deposit the money at the local bank at the end of the day, that money does not even spend the night in the bank. It's electronically transferred out to wherever Walmart has their centralized account. We heard from other people besides their professors and special aides and trade. We heard from the local people in Montana too. They were there to tell the story about how they made it in the system or in spite of it. And one of the stories was about a sheep herder who that same day had an appointment with her attorney to file foreclosure papers on the land that her grandparents had established the family on. We were also given some undercurrents of what went on in the communities. There was a poet, journalist, and a teacher that talked about the experiences that community had been through with teen suicide. And what happened to a school system that was where the children were all from ranches. And then the biggest platinum mine in the country opened in the same county. And the miners' children and the ranchers' children were together, and it upset the whole school system. The patterns changed so dramatically that the school teacher couldn't be in the school anymore. The young people dealt with it by doing things for themselves and then doing things for other people. And the adults, they had different approaches. In one county, the wool growers, they pulled their wool, and 35 families, they set to work cleaning that wool the best they could, and as a result, they got $32,000 more for the wool when it was sold. We were introduced to an organic ranch, 75 square mile ranch. It had Angus breeding stock, And twice a year they had auctions where they sold bulls. It's a very beautiful setting. The owner called it the Serengeti of North America. And that part of his ranch was for sale too. You could come in and go hunting with his guides. Unfortunately, he couldn't harvest all that the game that increased on his property every year because the hunting season is only 3 weeks long. One ranch family, under the wife's supervision, they dyed, carded, and spun and knitted the wool that they produced, mostly using local help. And the products were really hooed over and admired. They were also very expensive, but they sold well. And a pair of socks, $50. Another rancher's wife told us how she used a computer to market their cattle. And in a simplified version, it went like this. She would send out over her network, what will you pay for a carload of cattle? And when she felt the price was right, then the cattle would be loaded and sent off to the feedlot. We also had a series of workshops. There were six of them, but we could each only go to two. That gave us a glimpse of what community were doing to unhook from the system. And communicating and building your community was what revealed itself to me. And one keynote speaker, Bill Dons from Iowa, touched on that. He was working with Prairie Fire, Rural Action, and he talked to us about how he had started Bible study groups in congregations in Iowa, and how the people had become aware that they were somebody, and then had been empowered by that to do things in their community and bring changes about. While I've been writing this, NAFTA has been ratified by the U.S. Congress. We were at Focal made aware of that once it passed, we as the voters will never again have an opportunity of shaping its wording. All those negotiations are done in secret. I didn't, among the people there, detect any protectionist tendencies, but there was a very strong aversion towards this NAFTA. And it was foremost because of what people foresaw would happen to the Mexican farmers. The commodity prices and the land policies will cause thousands of farm families to be uprooted, and land consolidation will be very common. And I thought of what Pastor Jim has mentioned here, that during the Reagan-Bush years, a lot of people from Central America came north and came into the United States because of all the unrest that was in their countries. And I think we can look for another way from the south to come north of the border, because all these people cannot go into the Mexican cities. Along with what we learned in Billings in those days, we also had Bible study. A Presbyterian professor by the name of Marvin Sheeney opened up for us what Isaiah, Hosea, and Amos were saying to the ruling elite of their day about their agricultural intensification and use of power and resulting poverty. If today's preacher preached like any of them, most sermons would be political. When the church speaks up on behalf of the poor, it's building not just on the foundation of Christ, but it's continuing the prophetic tradition. What has occurred to me as I reflect back on Focal is that I need to explore deeper what you can accomplish when you live in community. In other words, talk to my neighbor. And I also need to look into the Danish heritage that I left behind many years ago. And I want to thank Holden Village for giving me an opportunity to be a part of this. Because there are so many things that I became aware of from being there that I would not otherwise have. You've been very quiet, so Scotty has a piece of paper there in front of him. Do you have a whole list of questions?
Yeah. I'm not sure how to do this Kitchener.
You have any questions about some of those things I touched on? Because I, from these 4 days that are over there, I mean, I just skimmed over the top. Scott?
A couple of questions. The first one, when you talk about the ranchers and protecting them now when it's this size, whatever size that is, whether it's the family farm or the family ranch, I guess something inside me remembers the ranch wars and the sheep slaughters. The Okanagan County, just north of Adamoff, they had the hay wars, and that was where the ranchers went out and burned down the haystacks of other settlers. The ranchers don't have a great place in my heart for how they have taken care of the land. Mm-hmm. I think about coyote slaughters, the amount that the Forest Service has to put into regulations to keep the ranchers from degrading watering holes. And I guess it strikes me, why are they coming to the church now to protect what they have? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm.
There didn't seem to be that stewardship up to this point that led to, you know, corporations getting such control of the land.
I was surprised myself that we went to a 48,000 acre ranch. It turns out that ranch used to be big. I guess it used to be from where it was there in central Montana to Miles City, 200 miles.
Do you wonder how many homesteaders lost their homestead to the original ranch?
I think it was the other way around. The land was homesteaded and then the ranch was forced to shrink. Because that land was settled in early 1900s, I think. And the ranch was there before that. The way that it was presented to us. The ranchers' dealings with the Forest Service was touched on. I heard him talk about that. And that, of course, would be different for each different management unit, how it turns out, because if you listen to the Sierra Club, they'll tell you about areas where the land is denuded because of too much cattle. And when you hear the good story that cattlemen have to tell, it's where some studies say, well, this land is as good now as it was when settlers first moved into it. And I'm sure that they can both be speaking the truth, and that we cannot generalize on that. There are areas where I don't think you would harvest anything if it wasn't because of sheep or cattle. Because we are not allowed to harvest game. This was one thing that was brought up at the focal previously, that some areas, if the ranchers could just have the natural livestock, so to speak, the deer, the mountain goats, or whatever was there, that then they could try to make a living having those animals there. But that's, they can't do that. That's not legal to use the deer that are there, for instance. That won't work.
There still seems to be a confrontation where, when it was in the ranchers' interest to be isolated and free market, you know, that's the way it should be. But when there's someone bigger who is taking advantage of them, mm-hmm. moving the poultry farm down, then free market isn't fair anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Who called foul when we had the sheep slaughters?
I hope the church did.
I don't think it did.
Yeah.
Most of you have probably seen the pyramid that Dan Erlander has in his book, where he comes like that, and God up here, and the priest, and the warriors, and the ordinary people, and the slaves on the bottom. We were shown a different graph where down here you have the farmers and ranchers, and up here you have the consumers. Here you have the feedlots, and here you have the food processors. The similarity between these two was striking to me, but what was pointed out to us was that it is so narrow right here where the food processors are before it goes back up to wholesalers and the consumers, that the only place there are variables on each end, these have so much control that they feel it's strangling them. And your question is a good one. People don't cry foul until it comes to themselves.
When they hold this carload until they get the price they want, are they considering the people who would like the food, or are they considering?
They're considering if they can stay in business. And one of the things that was very striking to me, these examples, the people who spun their own wool, the people that sold beef by the carload, was that they're still trying to make it on their own. They're not talking to the neighbor about how can we do it better. And in the workshops, there was very little about how do we form community and deal with this. I think the only example really was the wool growers that had the subsidy dropped along with the honey producers. And all of a sudden they had to do something or they wouldn't make it in this one. Sheep herder we talked to, she didn't make it. She and her mother were filing foreclosure papers. they did not ask, or she did not ask, that the government would have kept on the subsidies, but she lamented over how quickly the subsidy has been dropped, so that they weren't able to deal with the change soon enough. I can't really comment on that, because I don't know how soon it was dropped. But since it was compared with or put in the same basket with the honey producers, and I consider myself a beekeeper, I'm not quite sure that I'm entirely sympathetic with her grief, because the subsidy dropped just a little at a time, and it finally dropped so far down that it was no advantage to use it anymore when we were still dealing with honey. So we were able to cope with it and ease out of it, because we were not a big producer.
So isn't the message there, it's not to be a big producer and you don't get hurt as much, and to be diversified in your own farm?
I think so. I think that's part of the message. One of the examples that the gentleman from Prairie Fire in Iowa talked about was that these Bible studies had taken place in the churches. One group decided that the school system wasn't functioning like it ought to. It was a very poor area. The highest paid salary in the county was 98,000, which the superintendent in the school got. And the school didn't seem to be responsive to the community, so the Bible study group had one person elected to the school board, and that person asked questions, and it brought about change. In the next election, they had two more people from the Bible study elected, and that brought even more change. So they seem to have hadn't gotten a little flavor of their success, that banding together, they could do something. Several questions were raised about, well, when you just let people study the Bible, well, any group could take over. The fundamentalist could come in and do things, but Jill felt that we shouldn't be afraid of letting the word empower people. One of the workshops I attended had a gentleman from Kansas who had been a part of a team that was brought in by the governor some years ago when they had a lot of bank foreclosures. I never thought that bank foreclosures in small communities would be a big deal, but apparently it is. And he gave us a little flavor of that. The regulatory agencies just someday swarm in to the bank and look through everything. They close the bank. The people who have deposits get their money because it's insured. The people who have stock in the bank, they lose everything. The people who have stock in a bank and the people who borrowed money from the bank and probably weren't on time we're paying their loans back, which was part of the crunch that the bank was in and caused it to be closed, those people still live in the same community. And he said, that's where you really need to try to build reconciliation. And I had never thought of that, that looked at other people in this own community as being the cause of it, and never were able to speak kindly to those families, and even then passed it on to the next generation. So I began to realize that maybe the Kansas governor, when he appointed these people to go into those little community, really knew what he was doing. There was a lot of grief to be dealt with.
Was this an awareness reason, or like, is there suggested actions from this?
No, there aren't any suggested actions. I think the actions that I sort of assigned myself or contemplated were, I need to be better to communicate in the community where I live, and then look into success stories in other communities that can be used where I live, are really the actions. I did ask the rancher's wife, when she had given her presentation about how she sold cattle, if it wouldn't be a reasonable thing to form a co-op, because it's not in every rancher's, it's not a possibility for every rancher to have a carload of cattle to sell if you're just a small producer. And she didn't get from my answer that maybe that would be a good idea. She was an individualist. And one of the people who came there to do presentation came to me later and said, it is strange, people just cannot see that they need to do that. But there is a group of people who have seen that they have to do that, and those are the African American farmers in the Southeast United States. They would not be on the land at all if they hadn't formed co-ops. And maybe things have to get a lot worse before the ranchers and farmers out here start to talk to each other to find out how they can make it.
Just something strikes me when you say that is, she gets her carload of cattle into the tracks that are run on land that was given to the railroads, you know, individual, make it on their own. And yet once you stick in that train car, the rest of the United States has supported that industry by giving that. And where do we demand something back as a nation from the ranchers? I'm trying to think what it's called, but a unit, a cow unit on
animal unit.
Animal unit.
You're thinking about how the ranchers pay for BLM and Forest Service grazing rights.
Grazing rights. It's I just have a hard time seeing ranchers as a threatened group. They seem like they have a lot of subsidies, hidden subsidies, albeit grazing rights, transportation, land grant colleges as far as doing research for them. Compare that with the fishing industry and they have nothing. Compare with the apple industry and they have nothing. I'm struck with that, you know, ranchers would complain.
But you also just touched on the railroads and how they were started by having land granted to them. But there was a period not too many years ago when they went broke left and right and had to consolidate. So even the people who have, or groups in our society who have at one time been given things, get in such a bind that you can't take anything back from them because they've used it up.
They went broke, or they raped their own system, profiteering, and dumped the garbage afterwards, including all the workers involved. No. I see Weyerhaeuser doing that right now in the timber industry. Short-term profit-taking until all of a sudden the mills are going to all go broke. Well, it's easy to see that's going to happen now.
And then the spotted owl came along and threw something new in there.
Threw a scapegoat.
Personally, I think that's one of the best things that has happened to the American forest. There'll be something for our children to look at. And there will also be some forest to harvest in the future.
Right, right.
Rather than doing it right now.
That was all my questions.
Now that Scott is done, the rest of you can ask Chris. Well, you progressed very well on your sock while I was speaking.
I'm down to the toe. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming. You know, with a community down to the size it is now, to see 1/6 of it in here is really amazing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
More pleasant.
Yeah. And what makes them that?
Because I believe that in the last tour with these black women, that they love their bodies, and they are celebrating sexuality or sex. And where Madonna was the victim, and in the white pietistic sense, they are in the natural, celebrating what God has given them. You know, that's a trap to me.
Responses?
I don't know, the last one, I mean, I hardly ever get this the first time, so I mean, I need to, but they're saying about give it up, but they're still in the beauty parlor, mm-hmm. putting it all on. So I guess maybe I missed the point in there.
What do you make of that? Who's setting what standards in that last video? And who's doing what with those standards?
The women.
Okay, so who's setting the standards in the first place?
But the women. The Vogue. I mean,
or Vogue. Oh,
yeah, the magazines.
I mean, images from 1950, when they were really trying to feel the light in the and even a white image of beauty.
Oh,
ugly, you know? It was a real, it was real, it was saying one thing, but it was showing something else. It was really confusing and unsettling in my mind.
Yeah. But can we, is there anyone who has a different view of that, that the role of Vogue and the visual image of what beauty was in that video? And it seems, I thought too that it was the white, the image of, the white male created image of female beauty, which applies to both white women and to black women then, in the 50s. Were they simply agreeing to that?
No. They seem to twist it around and make it something that were empowering them. And so here they were in the beauty shop doing everything, but the message they were saying is, you know, girl, that guy's not worth your time. Give it up. But they're still doing all the rest. It's more that they were pursuing that beauty as a way to empower themselves, which is an odd twist, I think.
It's also an odd twist that makes more sense because it's done in 1993 using 1950s. It's another layer of critique of what was going on in the 50s, so that women in the 50s couldn't do that, subverted at the same time. But women in the 90s can look back and adopt something with this ironic distance. So it is women as agents now, but not as, which women couldn't be in the 50s. Or chose not to be.
Maybe that's why it was attractive to me. Because it is what I wanted to be when I was 21 and wasn't and can be now, but my body doesn't go quite along with it. But the spirit is there.
I wanted to say something about that Whitney Houston one. I found that offensive. I thought that was portrayed women as sexual objects. I liked the last one. I thought it had a good message, but I didn't care for that one at all. And I find it offensive that those two first ones used children, especially little girls dressed up in skinny costumes.
You raised an interesting question about the video. What is it possible for women to become the agents of our own sexuality without falling back into the stereotypical notions of our sexuality? Is it possible for us to enjoy it and to say it's natural for us? And this is, unfortunately, MTV is about as heterosexual a medium as you can find on planet Earth. And so the whole thing is premised on male-female heterosexuality, which is in the Whitney Houston video, except that it's an all-women video, which is stunningly unusual. So it raises some questions of lesbian identity as well in that video. But by and large, you're pointing to something that's there.
Well, the words were
satisfying.
I'm natural, I can give you what you want, this type
Isn't
of
that true,
bad, to me, that's a bad message.
Well, small group work, you can pursue that with the Because I just heard some other reaction that indicates we don't have unanimity on that one.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering about that video, and I was wondering, you know, on everything she was singing, and I said, well, do women really want to be that? Well, so often it's someone saying that to a man, or a man saying that to a woman, and it kind of dawned on me towards the end that this was an all-woman video. Could Whitney Houston, could the song be kind of this, with the chorus and everything, be singing about some type of female spirit that, and they're singing to women, that I'm every woman and I can give you what you need, to individual women. I wasn't sure, I kind of figured that out, and I don't know what the two words she, the one word she repeated twice at the end was.